Good morning.
Good morning.
Who do I have on the line? It's Terry with Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs.
This is Adley McCampbell with the Coastal Bend Center for Independent Living.
Okay, great. Glad to have you on the call.
Thank you, ma'am.
I'm sorry, did you say Atwood?
Atley. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Welcome. I think so far you're the only one on the call.
Oh, okay.
You and I.
Well, my name is Lori Hill. I'm learning about housing. I asked Atley if I could join him. I work here at the Coastal Bend Center also.
Great. Glad to have you both.
I thought there were going to be others as well.
Well, there have been in the past, and so I'm just waiting to see if any of our council members. There we go. Hello, did someone join the call?
Yes, this is Carissa from DSHS.
Hi, Carissa.
Hi.
How are you? I'm sorry if there was some confusion.
No problem.
I thought I sent, the listserv and things, but I'm sorry if I missed you. And Carissa's with DSHS. And then I hope to have Paula. She is with the REACH Independent Living Center in Dallas, and she's one of our council members. And I believe that she'll be joining the call. I think she had a meeting immediately before that was ending immediately before this one. So maybe we can just give folks a couple more minutes, and we'll just go ahead and get started. Would you all like to go ahead and introduce yourselves, Atley and Lori, to Carissa?
Yes, ma'am. My name is Atley McCampbell. I work at the Center for Independent Living. I am the Independent Living Housing Specialist.
Great. And Lori?
Yes, ma'am. My name is Lori Hill. I am the newly, just a couple months old, IL manager and learning about housing here at the Coastal Bend Center for Independent Living.
Great, thank you. And Carissa?
Sure. My name is Carissa Doherty. I am a program specialist with Adult Mental Health Services at Department of State Health Services. And prior to coming onto this position, I spent 7 years managing housing programs for local mental housing authorities.
Thank you. And then I thought I heard a couple more people join the call.
It's me, Terry. It's Paula.
Hi, Paula. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Great.
And this is Tanya Lavelle with Easter Seals.
Oh, hi, Tanya. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Terry?
It's great. Thank you.
Great.
Okay. Well, we've got 5 people on the call, and it's after 11, so let's go ahead and get started. We do have quite a few things to run through with this work group call. This is work group 1. And the goal of this work group was to look at adding additional resources to support the financing of integrated affordable housing and services to meet the needs of underserved disability groups and older adults. What I thought I would do, did someone join the call? A couple people joined the call. Great. Would you like to introduce yourselves, the 2 people who just joined the call?
Megan Sylvester, TDHCA.
Oh, hey, Megan.
Hi.
Elizabeth Baker, ATCIC.
Oh, hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
Great. And that's with Austin Travis County Integral Care.
Correct.
Okay. Got it. Okay. We're just getting started. You should have the agenda. The agenda, I attached the list of recommendations. And what I thought I would do, each group has met twice now, and we have come up with a list of recommendations. So I put that out on the website, and then what I wanted to do was to just go through the entire list of the recommendations so that each group can see what the other group's recommendations look like, and to add any, revise any, have discussion about those recommendations. So we've got a pretty good list. Does anyone have any questions or concerns about just starting with the first one on the list and moving right through them? Anybody have any suggestions? Or
will that give us time to talk about our own mission, so to speak?
Well, I think when we get to that work group, the work group one, that's what we're starting with.
Right.
So we can certainly start there, and then if we don't have time to get to all the recommendations, if we need to have another call, I'm certainly open to that. And this is going to be just the first stab at documenting these recommendations, and then of course I'll continue to communicate with people about the recommendations and what's going into the report. So there'll still be ample opportunity to continue discussion about any of the others. So is that all right?
Sure.
Okay. Well, let's just go ahead and start with the recommendations that this work group has come up with. And the first one that we talked about was just if there's any additional Section 811 funding opportunities that come in the future, for the state to consider applying for those funds. I think most of you know that Texas was a recipient of about $12 million for Section 811 project rental assistance. We are in the process of working to negotiate agreement with Housing and Urban Development. So we have submitted our revisions and we are waiting to hear back from HUD on that. But this item is, if there's any opportunities, let's look at and consider applying for additional funding.
One comment about that. Is there any reason why we limited that to the state? I mean, wouldn't we encourage any eligible entity in the state? Because I know that in times past, nonprofits have formed separate spin-off corporations that allowed them to apply?
Oh, sure. This particular recommendation was real specific to Section 811.
And right.
I'm not positive. Somebody can correct me if I'm wrong.
Terry, I believe what she's talking about is the old 811 program, which all the housing units were 100%, or sometimes it was only 98% for persons with disabilities. Under this new Project 811, it's the housing units can be no more than, well, here in Texas, because of our integrated housing rule, they can be no more than 18% reserved specifically for persons with disabilities. And in the application instructions, it was only state agencies that could apply this last round. Now that might change. HUD was given additional funding to fund this new 811 program, and they have not come out with what those guidelines are. But at least last time, it was only the state agencies that could apply.
Right. Yeah, I'm aware of that. I'm not aware of the 8%. When you're saying 18%, you're talking about scattered housing. You're not saying that the remaining, whatever it would be, 82% would go for other.
No, all of the monies will go for the target population.
Okay.
Within the application.
Okay.
It was just 18% of any individual multifamily development.
But on that particular round, it was totally limited to states as applicants.
Correct.
I'm just saying, if that were to change,
yeah,
I guess we would want anybody that could to apply, because our goal is to just get more affordable housing out there for folks with disabilities.
So what I'm hearing, Paula, is maybe that particular recommendation was specific to Section 811 funding,
mm-hmm.
which this round was to states. What I'm hearing you say is we really don't and I'm looking through the list, we really don't have anything in here that says something to the effect to monitor other HUD funding and other entities who might be eligible to apply to increase service-enriched housing. Something to that effect?
Right, and also if the guidelines for 811 change, you know, with future NOFAs, then
right,
we sure don't want to miss that opportunity.
Okay, so it would be something like pursue other funding from HUD or really any other resources.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So
we're thinking the way we can get it.
Okay, I'll just, and I'll put something together and you all can help me, you know, make sure that that's clear. So the next bullet was coordinate with public housing authorities, Veterans Administration, medical centers, housing and urban development, VA, supportive housing vouchers. And I know I had sent out some information before about those vouchers. We do have some Veterans Administration centers that my understanding is do not access those HUD-VASH vouchers. And that might be something for us to look at how we can, how we could do that in the future.
I'm interested that medical centers are included. Do they get some type of voucher that I don't know about?
It's the Veterans Administration. They coordinate with medical centers, and they get these specific, they're called HUD-VASH, which is, you know, Housing and Urban Development, Veterans Affairs Supportive mm-hmm. Housing Vouchers.
Okay.
And we have a number of those in across the state, and then we, not in too distant past, received additional HUD-VASH vouchers. But from what I could understand, and somebody could correct me if I'm wrong, we have some out there, the VA hospitals that are not accessing these vouchers, and that would be another opportunity for us to look at.
Why would they not be doing that? Because they don't have to administer them, right?
I don't know. I don't know all the ins and outs of that, but that's something that what we'd want to do with this recommendation is to look at that.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay, so the next bullet was convene the continuum of care organizations to identify ways to leverage that continuum of care and other funding, like, for example, home funding. There were some discussions about those continuum of care organizations across the state and how they might be able to leverage some additional resources. And there was some talk about notice of funding availability. Don't overlook the opportunity to encourage collaboration. Coordinate with the Department of State Health Services on their rental assistance and TDHCA Section 811 Project Rental Assistance Programs to analyze cost savings and impact on quality of life to provide data to consider establishing a state-funded rental assistance program in the future. I think one of the things that we've talked about is looking at that evaluation and being able to look at cost savings. I'm already looking at some information out there about, we had this discussion at our last council meeting, the savings to allow individuals to reside in the community versus the cost to serve them in institutions and the impact on not only their quality of life but also the cost savings that occur. So I'm looking at some different resources to be able to include some information about that in the biennial plan.
We have the TAC report, correct, from a couple years ago?
Yes. Which one is that?
It was a report that spotlighted, I think, 5 different states.
Yeah.
And, you know, their successful housing models, and I really think that we can learn a lot from those and take some of those recommendations that have already been, you know, packaged up for us and really just bring them to the state. I think that would be really easy to do.
Okay. And maybe tell me, so like North Carolina, isn't that one of them?
Yeah, uh-huh. And this is Tanya. I've actually done a whole lot of research on that model, and that's the one that at least I've pinpointed as the best, especially for, you know, the population that would probably be, you know, using some of the project access vouchers and things like that.
But didn't they have the added incentive of the Olmstead settlement that they had to make some provisions that we, you know, I'm still really struggling with this one in particular because of the mood of the legislature and just trying to figure out a way that we really could, you know, encourage lawmakers to support that kind of an initiative? What incentive could we use that would get through to them?
Well, I think, I mean, it's a shame that we have to call it an incentive that the DOJ came down on North Carolina, but I think you're probably right. But, I mean, just the cost savings, I think, is probably our best chance. And
there are
distinct cost savings that would, you know, result in expanding these housing programs and putting any state dollars into them.
Well, and, you know, another concern we have is that we being particularly independent living centers is that we would like to see these funds used to keep people from becoming institutionalized. That's just as important to us as getting them out of institutions. But it seems like a precarious balance because, you know, the potential for some abuse of that kind of a strategy is there. People are going to come out of the woodwork and say that they're at risk when they're not, you know what I'm saying? And then if you take away funds to keep people out of nursing homes initially, it may have an adverse effect on the funds that get them out. Does that make sense? Because I could see a greater influx of potential applicants wanting to be able to say, you know, I need a voucher to keep me out of a nursing home. And then that's going to pull a drain from the vouchers available to get people out of a nursing home. So I only bring that up because as we're contemplating what recommendations we would make in this regard, that's stuff that we have to consider. And how, you know, how we would structure our own voucher program if the state were to have one. I should live to see that day, but it could happen.
And what ways could you envision using this money to keep people from entering institutions in the first place?
Exactly. But the point I'm making is that unless there's two separate pools of funds, you know, if those kinds of funds are commingled to keep them going in versus getting them out, then what I predict will happen, and this comes from being in the movement for 35 years and watching it, is that lots and lots of people are going to come forward and say, well, I'm at risk of going into a nursing home and I really need these funds. And God knows if you are trying to live on $700 a month, you probably are at risk, you know. But then it could have an adverse effect on the funds that have been set aside or the vouchers, whatever, to get people out of nursing homes. And because the drain would be greater. But I think it's something that we have to consider as we come up with some kind of structure for a state voucher program for people with disabilities.
And that's what North Carolina had, was a state-funded program, right?
Yes. The one that was impacted specifically by the DOJ was for people with mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
But they have already, I mean, predating that, they have done a lot of innovative work around, you know, getting people with disabilities as a disability-neutral program into housing through, you know, utilizing things like the low-income tax credit process and a lot of state money.
Okay. And so the Department of State Health Services is sort of, kind of, you know, a state-funded rental assistance program for people with mental illness. Right now, that funding went to 18, so it's not statewide, but it went to 18, 19, Carissa, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but to provide rental assistance, and in some cases may have resulted in what Paul was talking about, preventing institutionalization, people going into state mental health facilities. Is that a fair statement?
Now, are you talking about the current program here in Texas?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
And I know Chris is on the phone. So I think what we were trying to point out here is let's look at both of these initiatives, or, well, one's a grant and one was state funds, is about $12 million.
Mm-hmm.
And look at what kind of an impact that had on cost and quality of life for these individuals. And then being able to tell a story, to be able to show $12 million helps, you know, X number of people remain in the community, go back to the community. you know, leave institutions, et cetera? Is that, are we all sort of...
Right, but would that, if we were to try to make that kind of recommendation, would it be like table funds? Would it be temporary? Because I don't see how the pool of funds would, there had to be a mechanism for replenishing. Because truthfully, you know, with only 30% of the disability population working, chances are that once people get on a voucher program, they're going to stay there. It's not going to, you know, it's not going to be like an 18 months. Everything's going to be all wine and roses, and they're going to be out making $40,000 or whatever. So,
well, the tenant-based rental assistance, at least TVRA, TDHCA's TVRA, is something that is a temporary. It can be up
right.
5 years, but then the goal is to help that person with rent until they can get a permanent voucher.
Well, and that's true for the mental health.
Right.
So they're buying them time then?
This is Carissa. I figured out how to unmute myself.
Good.
I'm going to chime in. But, yeah, as far as the DSHS rental assistance, it is in line with TDHCA's home TBRA funds, and that it's supposed to be kind of like a bridge subsidy. And what I hear your concern is that what about the folks that are going to need permanent subsidies?
Right.
And because the reality is that even if, you know, the bridge subsidy is really about sustaining them in housing until another subsidy, a permanent subsidy, becomes available. And so it's also, you know, that we need to maybe think about increasing the number of regular housing choice vouchers available, decreasing the amount of wait time or the number of local public housing authorities that have closed Section 8 wait lists.
Exactly.
How we can impact that aspect of it. You know, how can we impact the local public housing authorities building more public housing? You know, just, you know, increasing the housing stock across the board.
Or letting people that are on some temporary type of voucher move up on the wait list, you know, so that there is...
Prioritization for people with disabilities, for homeless individuals, that's another area that definitely needs our support.
And, I mean, doing, I guess, kind of a way to, I mean, you might have just sort of iterated this a little bit, but a way to do away with some of these concerns is just to expand the number of disability-neutral vouchers. Because at least from our experiences here at Easter Seals, the main issue for us is that we can't give people the subsidy they need to get into a place to live. That there are some places available, but we just don't have the vouchers to help people. Like
right.
Your waiting list, they're 3 years long.
Absolutely.
So, and that would be a way to address this without making it disability-specific, which at least in the North Carolina model was a concern, that perhaps later on down the line, you know, doing so much focus for just the population of people with mental illness would end up sort of eventually carving out people with other disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if you want to approach this from a broader perspective, I think definitely increasing the number of disability-neutral vouchers, which might be a way the state could, you know, God forbid, design their own program, would be a way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
While also, I mean, if it, you know, if the need is still there, preserving this kind of shorter-term program that the state has used now. But even, you know, an idea of possibly just expanding the dollars that are there now and kind of growing the voucher to make it longer-term. So people, you know, with mental illness who are struggling, you know, like somebody pointed out earlier, they're rarely going to get back on their feet within a year and a half. So making it so that these vouchers could become longer term as opposed to sort of just kind of, you know, crisis, if you will, would be another way to help people stay housed for longer.
Yes, because we know just wait list time can be years and years.
Right,
absolutely.
Right.
When you say these vouchers, Tanya, what these vouchers are you talking about?
These vouchers were the dishes.
Okay.
Yeah, the $12 million vouchers.
Okay.
And the fact that the state was willing to do that even at all is a step in the right direction for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably why it's really a great idea at this point in time to come up with some kind of a recommendation and kind of strike while the iron is hot, while people are thinking, you know, more positively, I guess, toward providing vouchers for folks with disabilities. So
I agree. Hopefully it's not just, you know, their concern about people with mental illness, as it seemed to be last session. But we can, you know, open it up to really paint the picture of this is not just somebody, you know, this doesn't just affect people with mental illness. The same problem exists across all disabilities.
Right.
Okay, so I wrote a couple of notes. So the recommendation was to coordinate with DSHS and TDHCA to analyze cost savings and impact on quality of life, to provide data for consideration. Are we all okay with that? That recommendation?
Well, as far as it goes, but that's not where we're going to stop, is it?
Well, you know, this kind of has come up before about looking at our statute and what we are. That's kind of why I went over that the last meeting.
Well, okay, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that we're going to actually go out there and build the housing, even though that might be exciting, but we at least need to come up with some recommendations that would give the legislature some idea of where we were going with, you know, a state voucher program. And yeah, the cost effectiveness is a good way to make our case, but then where do you go from there? How do you actually, if I were a legislator, I would go, well, would you see this structured, and where would the money come from, and all those questions they always ask, you know?
Okay, so help me with how you would like the recommendation to be worded. I mean, would it...
to propose some models of how a state-funded voucher program for people with disabilities might look.
Well, like suggest best practices or something like that.
Yeah,
best practices for developing a Texas-specific state-funded voucher program.
There you go.
Okay, and say that again, please, Tanya.
So
what would the recommendation to the governor and the LVB would be that, what, we would?
Well, what was the data piece you had? Because I think they need to go together.
Right.
But like she mentioned, if you just, you know, you can point out all the problems, but unless you have a plan of action, there's only so much you can do. So what was the beginning of the recommendation that's there now?
To coordinate with DSHS and TDHCA to analyze cost savings and impact on quality of life, to provide data for consideration of establishing a state-funded rental assistance program. So maybe we could say similar to the state-funded program in North Carolina.
Or just like, you know, based on...
Okay.
Yeah, or based on best practices...
in other states.
Yeah, in other states. Or, you know, I think, I forgot what I said earlier, but I liked that better.
I know, and it sounded really good.
Sorry, I didn't answer it.
It's been recorded. This
is right.
Okay, well, it's 11:27, so maybe before,
okay.
A little bit before that. I think I mentioned stuff about, you know, the Texas-specific, you know, state-funded, because I know how the legislature likes to run their own game.
Right.
So I think that would probably be a good thing to include in there in some form or fashion, that this is a Texas-specific plan.
I think it's good to reference that there are states that are doing it so that, you know, because they're not real big on, you know, piloting.
Yeah. I mean, I'm all about North Carolina if you want to put that in there. I think that's a great model.
Well, you know, I'm definitely going to be referencing the comprehensive analysis report.
Okay.
And so what makes sense to me is a sort of background for this recommendation that I do some summary statements about North Carolina and maybe a couple of other states, because that was the reason we contracted with the Technical Assistance Collaborative, is to provide some best practices. So, you know, maybe we can, you know, lay the framework with that comprehensive analysis report and then include this.
Yeah, and then maybe that would be the benefit of saying, you know, best practices from other states as opposed to narrowing it down just to one.
Right.
Because that way, you know, there's a much broader,
I guess,
bucket of ideas to pick from.
Yeah.
So if we could, in my opinion, if we could just totally recreate the North Carolina model and put it here, I would be a happy girl.
Yeah.
And
the data, you know, it's not going to reveal anything that we don't already know, because, you know, having done Money Follows the Person and trying to fight for those funds. We've said, you know, it costs this much per day for a person to stay in a nursing home and, you know, yada, yada. So that is information that's already known, but if we can beef it up and substantiate it, certainly that's good. But it's more like, where do we go from here now, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like you said, it's there. We just need to make sure and paint a picture of how we're going to use that and where we need to go with it and, you know, how we're going to make solutions as opposed to just, you know, constantly reciting the same statistics.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. So, Tommy, anything that you have to send me, that'd be great.
Sure, absolutely, yeah. I have a lot of contacts in the North Carolina system, so I'm happy to reach out to them or kind of send you. I'm working on a report now, so get a little more specific if that's helpful.
That'd be great because I'm really trying to pull together a lot of resources to begin writing this biennial plan, and that'd be really helpful. Appreciate
it. Absolutely. All right, I will do that.
Okay, appreciate that. The next one is training for Texas Department Association on people with disabilities and services available to support tenants. And we have already talked about doing some training, a property manager training is something, a manual property manager training manual is something that we have looked into for the Section 811 project rental assistance. And then we talked before at the council meeting about creating some videos about what service enriched housing is, how, you know, how it works, that kind of thing.
Are you in the work group 2 recommendations now?
No, we're still in 1.
Okay. My brain was having trouble tying that in.
Okay. Oh, well, I see what you're saying. Training. Well, add additional resources for service-enriched housing. I guess additional resources, we're just really talking about training resources.
Okay.
Is I think, kind of where we're going with
that. I was talking about money. But.
Yeah, and I guess I see resources as kind of broader than just money. But so the next one would be to coordinate additional housing and services partnership academies. Again, that's more, you know, resources and training. And you know, that's a big part of what we're statutorily required to do, is training and technical assistance. And so what we've talked about is just replicating that academy that we had back in May. And everybody just jump in whenever. The next bullet is coordinate with DSHS as they implement their rental assistance program and then work with the local mental health authorities to become tenant-based rental assistance administrators. The next bullet is...
I don't remember this group coming up with that. I must have missed a call.
Well, there are actually a couple, and I should have mentioned that in the beginning, that I've added.
Okay.
So, I'm sorry. I should have clarified that. So I've stuck in a few.
I was feeling really lost. I'm glad you said that. Okay.
I was sitting there trying to, and then sometimes it was just different things, different meetings that I've been in that I thought were applicable, and so I included those. I'm sorry, Paula.
This is Carissa. I can speak to that. It is necessary. That was a stipulation as part of the DSHS rental and utility assistance, is that all the LMHAs who got funded would become administrators. And what we're noticing is, well, they have until the end of the fiscal year to do that. But it is a lengthy process, and there is some hesitancy that we're noticing as far as the technical assistance support we're providing. So, you know, just realizing how lengthy a process that might be to kind of, and the support necessary to move the LMHs into a much more robust housing provider role.
So, let me make sure I heard you. A lengthy process, and they are receiving technical assistance from us, or were you talking about technical assistance that UDSHS are providing to the local mental health authorities as far as resistance?
As a part of the rollout of the program from DSHS standpoint, very few LMHAs to date have implemented or started that process with TDHCA to become administrators.
Okay.
And so the minimum, the feedback that we have received is that we'll get to it, or, you know, seems to be a lower priority, and they're not, we're trying to assist them in helping make the connection between once you become an administrator, you will have access to all these other funds, this will be a bridge subsidy, you know, just a lot of technical assistance on that aspect of how great it is and how important it is. Understanding, too, that TDHCA has a process and that there is a, you know, on that end, that will take some more time. So we expect probably in the summertime that there'll be maybe a rush to get all those, you know, that process started.
Okay.
This is Elizabeth Baker at ATCIC. I know, being one of the recipients of the DSHS funds, have not applied to become a TBRA administrator because of, honestly, lack of understanding of how the process works. And I know that there was discussion about doing a training on how to complete the TBRA administrator application, and that was never done, to my knowledge. I'm wondering if that might be something to look into.
And that's training by TDHCA?
Correct.
Okay, so let me, so that might be something that we need to include in this recommendation.
Well, I can, let me check with my colleague, Anna Sennenball, about what she's got scheduled. I know a training happened in December. I'm not sure at what level of technicality it included.
Okay.
But I know one happened in December.
And I can check on my end, too, with Spencer.
Yeah. I know she's talking to Spencer, so.
Okay. So the next bullet was to coordinate with DSHS as they implement the Home and Community-Based Services Adult Mental Health Program. It's a 1915I. It's a state plan amendment. So it's going to be a new program. From what I understand, it's about 100 or so individuals over the biennium that would be served in this new program. And that what I had listed here was to increase the utilization of the project access vouchers for the DSHS pilot. I know that historically those vouchers have not been utilized. Now, I just had a conversation with someone here at TDHCA and said that may not be the case anymore.
Yes, we have a wait list. We actually have a wait list. So excited. So the word is slowly getting out, and Liz is on the call, and she's been great about submitting a bunch of applications from Austin.
Great.
But we're kind of slowly getting the word out, and that wait list will actually demonstrate a more robust need, which we know is out there.
Which wait list? I'm sorry, I missed what
the for the Project Access Pilot
program. Oh, the 10 vouchers?
Yeah.
Okay. Great. And you said that the recommendation was going to be use the 1915i services in addition, kind of marrying those two things?
That needs to be included, I would think.
Right.
Yeah.
The kind of bullet that's behind that bullet was to increase the utilization of project access vouchers for the DSHS pilot.
Okay.
That perhaps individuals that will be going into this waiver can make sure and access the project access vouchers, or at least, you know, work.
Well, I think that might be a little bit confusing because the project access, it should say project access pilot vouchers, and then maybe you need to reference the 1915i program.
Okay, you just call it that? The recommendation was to implement, and I used what I got from Dina, Home and Community-Based Services-Adult Mental Health Program.
Great.
And then?
Increase the utilization of project access vouchers for DSHS pilot. Are those maybe two separate recommendations instead of, is that maybe a separate recommendation is to increase the utilization of project access vouchers for the DSHS pilot?
They strike me as two different things.
Okay.
But I feel like they could be recommended in tandem, because I think, at least from my perspective, the 1915i services need to go hand in hand with vouchers, because that's the most fragile population and they have the largest chance of success that they're going to be housed. So I think whether or not we specify it to just the pilot vouchers, or, you know, the project access in general, or even to the newer Dish's rental vouchers that just came out. I think the 1915, I would like to see it recommended as kind of like a paired service.
Yeah, that's, I think that's where we were going with that, and that this may be one that I added. That was where my head went with that, so maybe I just need to separate out and then also have another one that says overall to increase the utilization of project access vouchers. Okay. And then, by the way, Krista, the person that I talked to here at TDHCA, sang your praises for getting those vouchers filled. So thank you for all that work you're doing.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, it is great. So the next bullet was to encourage DSHS to expand the rental assistance program to all LMHAs. So I guess that might look like maybe an assumption that DSHS will be able to show that that infusion of money, you know, resulted in these outcomes and then ask for more. More money, the next legislative session.
Is there already a recommendation here about asking for more money for those vouchers?
I'm sorry, did you say is there?
Yeah, is there something we've already recommended further up? I have all these notes scribbled so I can't see anymore, but is this the kind of the recommendation for increasing the funding for these vouchers?
For the
dishes ones that we were for, yeah, because the recommendation that you just mentioned said expanding the rental assistance to all LMHAs. So is this the only time where we're mentioning that we need to expand funding for this?
Okay, so let me make sure I'm clear. This bullet about encouraging DSHS to expand the rental assistance program, that's the rental assistance program that they have going on now in the 19 LMHAs.
Right.
So this one is saying ask for more so that all 39 LMHAs can benefit from that money. Are you talking about...
Or additional money. Yeah,
well, that's what I was talking about, but I know that in the application process, I mean, this might be a better question for the LMHA representatives on the phone, but aren't only some LMHAs really doing housing? Or, like, you know, they were denied this money for a reason, and I don't know if it's because there wasn't enough and that all of the LMHAs were equally qualified for it, but I wonder...
There was not enough money initially, and then they did a needs and capabilities assessment. They had all the LMHAs were open or eligible to apply, and then they did an internal review about their needs and capacities to kind of determine who would get what and out of the limited funds.
Okay. Is it your opinion then that all LMHAs would be able to use this money and help people be housed, or should we rather just generally ask for more funding so that dishes can, you know, dole out more to LMHAs who are doing, you know, the best job at this and possibly allow others to begin programs?
Yeah, I would suggest keeping it open.
Okay.
Just so as we build infrastructure within some of the LMHAs are needing more support for sure in terms of ramping up their housing programs.
So it would just be encourage DSHS to expand the rental assistance program, period, instead of saying to all LMHAs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
it does.
Okay. I know these last several ones are ones that I added, but it was expansion of the Aging Disability Resource Centers. DADS is in the process of expanding those, and that actually goes with the balancing incentives payment. Those really go hand in hand. Because in order for the state to receive the balancing incentives payment, they have to implement a no-wrong-door system across the state, so hence expanding the ADRCs. The next one is expansion of program for all-inclusive care for the elderly. During the last legislative session, DADS received funding to expand that program, so this recommendation is to continue to expand that. DSRIP, the Delivery System Redesign Incentive Payment, that's really specifically related to the way Texas is implementing that program, is particularly for behavioral health. So there's a number of behavioral health initiatives that are going on across the state that have been funded, and I know you guys, Austin, Travis County, Integral Care, are really heavily involved in that. And So this was to continue that effort. And I know some of that does involve housing and services in different parts of the state. And I already talked about balancing incentives payment. So that's it for number one, work group one, add additional resources. Did anybody have anything else you wanted to add to that, or do we want to go through the other two and see if those may be related to something? We have about 10 minutes left.
I want you to go back to the ADRCs and tell me what funding does this make available to the state?
Okay. The Balancing Incentives Payment Program is called BIP.
Yes.
And it is an opportunity for the state to apply for this program. The state receives additional federal match if they do these three things, and that's make sure that there's no wrong door. This is for aging and disability, that we have conflict-free case management, and that we have a single assessment tool. And so part of implementing the BIP program is expanding the Aging and Disability Resource Centers as the no wrong door for people to apply for services.
So the increased match goes to which state entity and for what?
Oh boy. I don't know the specifics of where the specific money goes. I know the state receives additional, and I don't remember if this one's the 2% or the 6% additional match. It's been a while since I've worked in that program, but I can supply, provide some more. I will provide more information about BIP in that recommendation. But
yeah, I'd appreciate that. And I guess to me it seems almost like an oxymoron to say no wrong door, but then the only door is the ADRC.
Well, what that means is if today in some places, if you walk into one of Dad's offices for the community-based alternatives program, for example, but you're a person with an intellectual disability, you get told to go someplace else. And so what it means is anybody can walk into an ADRC, whether you're a person with an intellectual disability or whether you're a person with a physical disability or whether you're a person that's an aging Texan. And you can go in that door, and then you get referred and you get assisted from there. So it's rather, in the past, you've got an AAA, Area Agency on Aging. So if you're elderly, you have to go into that front door. You've got local authorities through DADS, 39, I think it's 38 now, local authorities. If you're a person with intellectual developmental disability, you have to go through that door. You have to know which door to go in. The Aging and Disability Resource Centers are intended to have one place where you can go to access services. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's called no wrong door. It just means that there's no wrong place for you to walk in. You walk into one place, and you can access services.
And this is for eligibility purposes, but not for direct service delivery.
Well, no, it would be for direct service delivery as well. If I walk in, and I want to get put on an interest list for the Home and Community-Based Services Program for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and I walk into an Area Agency on Aging, they're going to tell me I have to go someplace else. Whereas today, if I walk into an ADRC, they're going to direct me, and I'm going to get to go through that door. Some of them even have consolidated databases. So you go in, and you tell your circumstances one time, and that's it.
That's really interesting, because it must look very different on paper than it is in actuality. Because here in the Dallas area, And we're members of the ADRC, but primarily what they do is provide training for members on relevant topics. And then, you know, I guess they have a database where they can refer people to the correct agency when they want to apply for something, but it's not like they're all sitting around in some central location providing services.
Some do. Some ADRCs are co-located. Some aren't. Some have central databases, some don't.
So then you can't just make blanket statements about them because they all have some different idea of how they're going to function, evidently. I'm just saying.
No, I see where you're going. I think that what the intent is to get to that point. I don't think we're there yet.
Well, just personally, this is just me going on record. I don't like that recommendation, and I don't like it being part of the recommendations of Work Group 1. So, if I had my say, I'd vote again it.
You would vote to not expand the Aging and Disability Resource Centers across the state?
You know, Polly, this is a discussion we need to have later, but it's very possible that I would, yeah.
Okay, well,
The only thing I didn't know about was that it made us eligible for a greater percentage of match,
mm-hmm.
You know, but I don't...
Well, I know that DADS was going in that direction anyway, prior to...
Yes, I know that's true.
...payment, and so perhaps I'm just not articulating the vision, you know.
Well, and I think what you're thinking of is how you're defining resources, but my thought was when we started this is that it really had to do with resources for housing per se, specifically to increase, you know, the affordable housing stock for folks with disabilities. And so that's why I feel like it doesn't really belong in our recommendations, because I don't see it doing that.
Okay, and I just keep coming back to the council's definition of service-enriched housing. It's housing and services working together. And so that's why all of these recommendations, some of them are housing and some of them are services. Because you can't have service-enriched housing without both of them.
You got to start with the housing.
Well, I that might be a chicken and egg conversation. Because you can't move out into, and if you find the housing and you don't have services, you can't do that either.
So, well, this is Carissa, just stepping in. I mean, we might want to promote the HUD 202 housing options specifically for this population.
Okay.
Well, that's true. You mean for seniors?
For seniors, yeah.
Yeah.
And tell me more about that. Is that a recommendation?
Yeah, similar. You could just add it in line with the Section 811 funding opportunities. It would be Section 8, Section 202 funding opportunities.
Yeah, I can go for that.
So pursue funding for HUD 202 housing?
Yeah.
Is that, did I get that right?
Yes.
Okay. Pursue funding for HUD 202 housing.
Another model that I saw used in California a long while back when I was out there working was that housing authorities like in LA and Orange County did a set aside of vouchers, long-term vouchers, for people with disabilities who were, they had to be, you know, consumers of vocational rehabilitation, independent living centers, but that was a cross-disability definition because, you know, those entities serve people with all types of disabilities. But the thought was that the voucher would help them as they move toward greater levels of self-sufficiency. And I just wondered if anything like that's been done anywhere in Texas?
Well, my my thought is that tenant-based rental assistance is designed that way.
Well, yeah, but that this was permanent. It didn't have a time limit. It was ongoing. You know, like once you got one of those vouchers, then you had it.
I see. Okay, well, one thing that is not on this list and that I wanted to add, and that's the capacity building initiative that Mark Gold and Steve Ashman have talked about, where they have the conversations with public housing authorities and HUD and I think it's CMS, and they are working with public housing authorities to set aside vouchers for, in this particular case, money follows the person, which are people leaving institutions.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he reported at one of our meetings that they have gotten over 146 housing choice vouchers set aside, and I think it was close to 40 public housing units set aside. Agreements from 12 different public housing authorities, big ones.
Well, that's awesome.
And so I was going to include that.
Mm-hmm.
Would be a recommendation to continue that effort.
Exactly. That's a really good model because, you know, it, without something like that in place, there's a real risk that people that, you know, got out of nursing homes and that everybody worked so tediously to accomplish that goal, and then they end up losing the voucher eventually and back to the nursing home, you know. So that's really, really important piece.
Yeah, I think it is, and I think that's good, and so I'll make sure and include that one. Okay, well, we're almost out of time. I would encourage you all to look through Work Group 2 and Work Group 3. Did anybody have, we have a couple minutes left, we don't have time to go through each one of them, but having looked at Work Group 2 and Work Group 3, you can see some, you know, overlap, some redundancy. Does anybody have any comment?
Yeah, this is Carissa. I was glad to see that another work group is working on addressing criminal backgrounds.
Yes.
And how much of a barrier that is for getting people into housing and helping them kind of pass initial eligibility criteria at the PHA level and at the landlord market, you know, open marketplace.
Absolutely.
So unless we're adding that to our policy recommendations, I think we're kind of missing a whole subsection of people that we really want to help.
And so you're okay. There's really three, I believe, recommendations related to that. Are you cool with those recommendations? Review policies and review possible TDHCA resources, and then TDHCA continue to participate on the reentry task force. Does that capture it, Carissa?
Yeah, it does. And maybe TDHCA could be kind of a leader in that model. As I'm learning, TDHCA doesn't have really any control over the local public housing authority. They're all operating independently.
That's right.
And so it makes it a challenge, you know, to
right,
and policies, you know, on this broad level.
Right, right.
Where the work does need to happen, you know, at the local level. But
right. That's what sort of came up in the last conference call that we had, was how much does TDHCA really have control over those three recommendations? Not a lot, but the other thing the topic that came up related to that was, I see these recommendations are recommendations that go just beyond what TDHCA can do. I'm approaching these recommendations much broader than only TDHCA.
You know, the great irony of that is that there's a higher incidence of alcohol and drug abuse within the disability population, we all know, and that's documented. But TASER in particular, because it makes, you know, possession a felony, then that impacts, again, the person's ability to get to qualify for housing.
Definitely.
And that's kind of unfair in a way, because it's not a felony in a lot of states, but here it's like a double whammy. You know, you've got to deal with the disability angle and the lower income, plus you can't get approved anyhow because you've got a felony that's not a felony in a lot of other states.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if this is kind of in the vein of the HHSCC, but kind of speaking to that, I've been doing also a lot of work on the Oxford House model.
Oh, yes.
And that was something that, you know, the legislature gave more money to last session. And Oxford houses are not based on criminal background. Like, it's democratically run, so houses can decide whether or not they want to accept people with criminal backgrounds. Mm-hmm. So they're not immediately disqualified, like a lot of, you know, HUD.
Right.
You know,
HUD, but aren't they halfway houses, though?
Aren't they what?
Aren't they halfway houses?
No. It's a type of a kind of a sober living situation. So they provide people with substance abuse problems.
Right. I'm familiar with them, but I thought they were time limited.
No. I mean, generally, people. Yeah, they're houses for, I think it's 6 to 8 people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just for people who are in, you know, they're interested in recovery. And I think I saw a presentation about it last week. And I think the average stay is about 9 months. But people can stay however long they want. So a lot of people transition out of it. But it's not, it can be permanent if people, you know, if that's what they want it to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, lost my train of thought. I heard that presentation as well. Oh, I think the reason that there could be circumstances where people that do reside in those Oxford houses would fall under our service-enriched housing definition, which would be people with disabilities and aging Texans.
Okay, yeah. I mean, because I was asking about it, and they said they're definitely, I mean, it's sort of just up to the population, if that makes sense. I mean, it's really just based off who is interested. So if somebody with a disability wants to go in here, they can.
They could.
Uh-huh. I don't know if that's something, you know, how common that is, but I know that there is a high overlap of, mm-hmm. you know, mental illness and substance abuse within general disability populations,
right.
especially with veterans. So, you know, that might, I don't know if this has a place in our recommendations or not, but the state is definitely backing,
yes.
you know, starting to buy into this model more. So it might be, you know, another kind of supported housing option.
Thanks for bringing that up. That's
sure.
a really good point. The other thing I wanted to bring up, Donnie, I think it was Donnie Green, who was on our previous call, talked a little bit about TDRA, you know, and that they, and Mike chimed in, that most of our programs just look at program eligibility but do not look at criminal history. So there is no requirement to access a TDRA voucher. We do not look at criminal history. And so in some of the other programs, we don't as well. Properties, that's a different story. But any other last comments about the other two? If any of you want to sit in on the next call, because we, you know, I know on the first call we got through all of them. So if you any of you want to sit in on the next one, it's going to be tomorrow from 10 to 11. So if you want to sit in again and maybe talk, there might be more discussion. All the calls are different depending on, you know, who's on the call, and the discussions kind of go different places, which is great. We get a lot of real different input. So feel free to sit in on the call tomorrow, and then let me know if we want to have another call, or I will be communicating the recommendations back out to everybody in the next couple weeks. Okay?
Great.
Okay. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Terry.
Great. Bye-bye. Have a great
weekend,
everybody.
Good day.
Bye-bye.
We're sorry. Your conference is ending now. Please hang up.